You guys ready to welcome up our friends, They Might Be Giants? Come on, are you really ready to welcome up our friends, They Might Be Giants? Please welcome John Linnell and John Flansburgh.
Hey.
Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Sir. Sure.
Oh, welcome.
Thank you.
It is great to have you here. And we are looking forward to hearing your, I hear you make music.
Yes,
we'll be
gigantic steel buildings are our favorite venue.
You can tell how good the acoustics are.
Purpose built.
Well, it is great to have you on stage. You know, oftentimes you go and you see musical acts and, you know, it's just music and all you hear is the song. And I think it's really awesome that you were willing to come and actually talk to us in addition to just playing your musics.
Yes.
And so thank you very much. In particular, the reason why we wanted to hear from you is I think that the way you've approached your career, the way you've approached building, making, doing, and creating, not just the music, but everything around your music, really resonates with the kind of audience that we have, right? We're kind of geeks, we're nerds, we're doers. Do you identify as geeks?
You know, we grew up in a very different era than now. I think, you know, in the 70s, you know, being an outsider had a very different kind of social status that I think you really wanted to transcend. And so those were our teen years. But I think, you know, we're, you know, definitely interested in culture and we're interested in sort of pursuing ideas to sort of their extremes.
Right.
And I think that's all part of, that is part of, I mean, the definition of like geeking out is something very familiar to us, you know, becoming obsessed with an idea and sort of taking it as far as you can and sort of just being self-defined. I mean, those are all like wonderful impulses.
Right, but the point is we're still shell-shocked from being punched in the face for being geeks at early age. So we're not, you know, we're still a little afraid of that label.
See, we have this great history, though, of really, I think, like composing, like building this infrastructure around like the act that is, you know, They Might Be Giants, right? Like whether it's actually the music, like the accordion, for example. I have to imagine that at this day and age, if you play the accordion as often as you do, like you probably have to really know how it works. Like if you repaired your accordion.
I can do minor repairs on the accordion. We have a guy in our crew who helps me.
Really?
Yes.
He's probably one of the like elite, he's probably the highest paid person in the band, right? Like there's like four accordion repair people in the world.
He is one of the only accordion techs in music today.
Yes.
And of course you had, you know, back in the day, I remember from the first album, you know, the They Might Be Giants album, on the back cover it said, you know, you had dial a song free if called from work.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so this sort of like communications has always been a part of really the act. And it was, if I remember correctly from what I've read, and like tell me if this is right or wrong, that it was just an answering machine in like one of your apartments in Brooklyn.
Yes. It's a little bit of a Shaggy Dog story, so stop me if I say too much. But basically, in 1982, we started the dial song, we started the band. And then soon after, we bought a phone machine and put it in my apartment. And at that time, phone machines were actually emerging technology. Like, only people in New York City had phone machines.
Like, fancy socialites.
Well, it was like working actors and photographers who had to make a point. People who would have had, message-taking services. People who had answering services were the first people to buy phone machines. And those were kind of New Yorkers. Your mom did not have an answering machine back then. And people found them very, very strange. But for us, you know, we were just a local band in New York, and there was a tremendous amount of kind of cultural gatekeeping going on. And if you ran a club, you had to make sure that all the bands that played in your club fit the style of your club. So if you were kind of like a gothy club, you wouldn't book this, or if you're a performance art club, you wouldn't book that. So it was very hard to kind of find avenues for what we were doing. And one of the nice things about the dial-a-song service is that it was completely democratic and completely self-defined by our music, and we could just put an ad in the paper and say, call this number and check out this thing we're doing. So in some ways, we got to kind of leap over a whole lot of nonsense. But in other, I mean, I think the thing that's hard to remember is that back then, when there were those kinds of gatekeepers, they were also the style makers. They really defined how the culture worked. And you couldn't, ultimately, you couldn't leap over them completely. There wasn't like a huge DIY industry. There wasn't even college rock. There wasn't even college radio yet. So
colleges had not yet met rock.
Yeah, so
they were still waltzing.
Yeah, so alternative rock was still sort of a glimmer in REM's eye at that time. And we got somewhere with it, but by and large, I think the general response was like, half of it was like, that seems kind of pitiful. There was actually seemed like it might scan as a bit of a desperate move.
Right. Well, we picked up some sympathy votes. Felt sorry for us.
Could people leave a message too?
Initially,
and then eventually it got overwhelming. There was also demoralizing, I think. Some of it was just way too negative.
Was there anyone who sat through the whole song and then left the message thinking they were talking to someone else?
Yeah.
Oh, well, famously, there's a recording on one of our early compilation records that is just a very small excerpt from, I think, an hour-long conversation she was on a conference call calling us, and she had no way to hang up our end when she was finished. So we got this amazing, long discussion, which begins about us and then moves on to other subjects.
It actually moves on to a conversation about how the guy upstairs is leaving his bathtub overflowing.
Yeah.
A classic New York conversation.
It was very New York.
But there was also this one very weird aspect to the era where Dial-A Song took phone messages, which is that single women all across, or maybe just women in general, all across New York City would have the number on them and give it to boyfriends that they wanted to ditch. So the message that you'd get, I would be listening to the messages, and the message would come in and be like, "Hey, Sarah, it was really nice meeting you the other night. Man, that was a weird message. Hey, listen, I'd really like to get together." And it was just like this kind of grim.
Well, the best part is knowing that it was like a 2-minute song or something. The whole.
That's right.
They still didn't get the message.
They were still really desperate to connect with this person.
I think Sarah was really judging the guy a little too soon. He had patience. He had tenacity.
That's right. He had good taste in music.
He could have been a keeper.
Now, did you sit there when you first launched it and you took out an ad in the paper and just sit there and all of a sudden you see the machine go and start doing remember how you hear the sound of the tape?
Right.
And
all that? Yeah.
And you're like, oh, people are calling.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's incredibly, it's very entrepreneurial. I remember when we launched Twilio, the day we launched, me and my co-founders, Evan and John, are you here?
They are not here.
They're not?
They are distinctly not here.
What is more important? I'll tell you a funny story. I'm going to divert. So John, one of my co-founders and I, we had this game a long time ago. And I've known John since college. We had this game where you got points, and it's like a lifeline. It's one of those games that never ends in your whole life. Mm-hmm. You get a point every time you're able to sneak the lyrics of a fingertip into conversation without the other person noticing.
Wow. That's a very esoteric game.
It's common, right? Everybody, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so the easiest one I found is you just sort of walk up, what's that blue thing doing here?
Right,
and you've got 2 seconds to kind of call it out, and if you miss the opportunity, it's like you got a point.
Excellent. Well, have you what's the Blink guy? He wrote a fantastic story. Malcolm Gladwell has this fantastic story about working at the Washington Post about trying to slip the study raises new and troubling questions. It's definitely worth the read. It's basically him and his co-workers had a contest to see who could introduce the line, study raises new and troubling questions, into the most number of articles.
Published.
Yeah, published
articles. So it's like provably winnable games.
Yes. Right. Because it's the perfect headline for, an article about a study.
I don't remember what I was talking about before.
Doesn't matter.
We were talking
about... But I think, tell me, is this true, though? So the answer, I read somewhere at some point that you would go through like an answering machine like every few months because
yes.
the motors would burn out because people kept calling and yeah. the tape rewinding and all that.
It was a very analog world. I mean, there also was a place that repaired them in New York City. You know, they weren't open 24 hours a day, but they could have been for us. But yeah, it was a long evolution. You know, it's very interesting seeing how the perception of the idea has shifted over the years, because it really was. I was just looking at a interview we were being interviewed by the BBC in like 1990 or 91. We had just had a top five hit song, and like, we were a pop band, just like any other pop band on Top of the Pops, you know, kind of doing our little cultural victory lap. And the interviewer was really fixated on the idea of like how we were just into gimmicks. And she, in a course of a 5-minute interview, she asked exactly 5 questions, and they were like, are you into gimmicks? When will you tire of the gimmicks? Do the gimmicks ever get old? Why do you like gimmicks so much? Please stop yeah. with the gimmicks.
She had a bet with one of her coworkers.
It was, yeah, exactly. It felt like that. And, you know, we were just, like, all jet-lagged and kind of going, like, yeah, lady, I don't know about this gimmick thing. But what was strange about it was that by doing the dial-a-song and doing all these things that seem very public and very kind of, you know, pointed out towards finding an audience, we were really not playing the mystery date game of being a pop act. Like, the whole thing of being a pop act at that moment was being as unknowable but alluring as possible and having people kind of come into you by suddenly going like, hey, my band's playing down the street and we might have some beers. Like, it suddenly seemed...
Right, demystified.
Way too
demystified.
Yeah, exactly. And just, like, intrinsically uncool. Like, and... What's interesting about the culture now is that everything has really flipped a 180 where virtually, you know, like Beyonce is like, you know, doing like, come on over to my streaming service. You know, the world of like putting yourself out there in just kind of a welcoming, unneurotic way is you know, that's where things are at now. You know, it's just a very different kind of sort of the pH balance of the cultural pond water has really changed.
The cultural pond water.
Yeah, well.
So you guys have always been using, like, whatever the technology is of the day, I feel like you've been pushing the boundaries as a musical act and as artists in order to harness it. Like, you know, you had the answering machine at one point. You had, you know, you were one of the first to put MP3s on your website.
We worked with eMusic right as they were launching their crazy thing.
Right. So we had an all downloadable album, download only album, before that seemed like a good idea. Or we did. I don't think we really even.
But Jeff, I do want to point out with pride, we completely dodged the CD-ROM bullet.
That's true.
The interactive.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
We were offered crazy money.
We didn't get on that train.
We could have wasted a full year of our lives making something that,
like, everybody
is just landfill now.
Would want the, you know, the They Might Be Giants experience.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
What's behind door number two?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And my sense is like we were not like ahead of any technologies, but we were looking around to see how we could repurpose what was available. I mean, the phone machine, you know, existed and was new and was obsolete over the course of the time that we were still using. In other words, you know, we didn't find a good substitute for the phone machine well into the period when other people had other systems going on. And for us, the actual physical answering machine was still the best solution for us. So we were kind of, you know, old timers, but, you know, probably by most standards.
But when, like, most of the music industry was just, like, throwing lawsuits at everybody.
Right.
But you were thinking, like, hey, actually having people listen to our music seems like a good idea.
That's true. We never jumped onto the lawsuit thing either.
No.
Maybe that's our next...
We should get more litigious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's, oh, exactly. That's cool.
If you know any lawyers.
Chuck, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And then again, like, you were like one of the first to do it without DRM, to offer high quality like FLAC recordings, like all sorts of things.
Well, that was really just a fan, that, listening to fans. We sort of found out about that community through our audience, and they were very vocal and just really wanted it. So we just sort of tagged along on that idea. But I mean, I think in general, like, if you see emerging technology as just an opportunity to do something creative, you know, it's a pretty exciting way to kind of live your creative life.
Yeah, I think the one thing that excited us early on, which was maybe the only truly prescient thing that we've done, is we thought people don't want to leave their homes, so we'll get the music to them, and that was, you know, in 1983 when you could only do that through a dial-a-song service.
Now, yeah, the original MP3, basically.
Yeah. So that was now it's just normal. But
so we started saying like this. So the machines kept burning out, and like you'd keep buying new ones, and then you retired it in startlingly late. Like it went out for 20 years.
Yeah. Well, the machine retired itself by just being unfixable at a certain point.
Did you literally keep repairing the same machine?
We did. We had a stack of these Recordicall 375s, which were great machines in their day. They had a cassette with an unlimited outgoing message and a separate cassette with the that would record the call. So it was very perfect for us, and there were no other machines that did that.
And also the fidelity was shockingly high.
That's right.
Like all the a lot of the contemporary telephony is very bandwidth limited because they figure you're just leaving a voice message. I don't know how many other people were putting music on their phones at the time. Probably none. But for whatever reason, it just happened to sound pretty good.
Did you do anything? You didn't do anything special when you recorded them or like transferred them. You didn't try to make them sound good.
Well, we did. We had to limit. In some ways, this really informed our whole process because all of our demos were funneled through Dial-A-Song, and Dial-A-Song forced us to simplify the arrangements so that you could make sense out of them over the phone. So I think probably there's certain ticks that we still are interested in. Loud lead vocal up front, not too fussy. Our impulse was always to overarrange things, but we were very much limited by what you could.
We would have been much more closer to Brian Eno if we had not.
That's right.
If we had not done the Dial-A-Song
wall of answering machines.
Well, yes. If only we'd had a wall.
I mean, the cruelest thing about the phone machine was that if somebody didn't like the song, we knew right away because it would start up and then 20 seconds later, it would
hang up.
Rewind.
Right.
Yeah. And that would be like, well, that ain't working. So we would actually put the we would tend to make the vocals very loud so people would hear the words. We also came to understand that people really liked the words, which, you know, was, I mean, we're songwriters and, you know, we're hooked into melody and all sorts of other things besides words, but it did make us, in the same way that like a DJ is probably really aware of the kind of baseline things that audiences really vibrate to, it was hard not to notice that the loud words really.
That's stuck. Really fascinating that, like, you know, 11 kilohertz, you know,
exactly.
Mono is actually an important part of your musical
career. It was an important constraint for us. Also, enunciating was another, that's something we drew from that, which we still over-enunciate.
Huh. What,
which really cuts down on our day drinking.
It sounds like another interesting point in the musical act of the Envy Giants was you recorded the theme song for The Daily Show.
That's yes, we did.
Right, and that is like
although,
been on the air
although
now.
A lot of people don't know that. I mean, you know, I think
you know that?
Speaking of, nobody
know it.
Nobody knows it.
Nobody knows it.
I mean, you know, speaking of lawyers, like, you know, if we had, we should have gotten like that thing in the, you know, in the credit where it's like actually says like theme music performed by the MIP Giants.
Right.
But you know, it was the theme.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Yeah. Credit, given where credit is due, the theme was actually written by Bob Mould of the band Husker Du, and he did a glorious job, and we kind of were brought in to make a more kind of a orchestrally kind
of
copy.
Well, we wrote the news music that precedes the guitar theme which is written by Bob Mould.
So the guitar theme was like the all along.
That was the original.
And then
theme,
the
yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, it was only a few months before we were brought in. It was like they to fix the mess.
To
be the yeah exactly the fix.
No, I mean basically the show wanted the veneer of a more real news show. So they added the sort of kind of ABC Nightline intro section, which we also put together for them. And then we redid the Dog on Fire rock theme with...
Is that the name of
Dog on Fire? That was the name Bob Mould gave to the theme.
It's called Dog on Fire.
Yeah. Dog on
Fire. Yeah, but we added trombones and sort of just made it a little bit more like to fit in with the rest of the music stuff. So...
And you've done a number of TV shows as well.
Absolutely.
Yes. If you have a child under the age of 5, you are probably very familiar with our standout track, The Mickey Mouse Clubhouse and Hot Dog. See, now we're getting a response.
Right.
See, this and it's like it's like a very interesting sort of faceless thing to be involved in, but it's, you know, that song, those two songs on The Mickey Mouse Clubhouse are in 24 hours a day across the entire world. Being played, you know. I mean, about three quarters of my mortgage has been paid by that song alone.
I'm
a thankful man
for Mickey.
Yes.
For Hot Dog.
Yes. Yeah.
Hot Dog. Hot yeah. Diggity Dog.
Yeah.
What? So you've got a number of these. Songs with like mysterious background. You can talk about any number of these, but I have a question about one of them.
Okay.
That I think like a bunch of science geeks would enjoy hearing the background of. So I have a special relationship with Why Does the Sun Shine?
Right.
Right? So you guys know that song? There's the original version, which I love, like the B side, it was like a B side, I think, or
it's
it was
on
a single.
On an EP, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you released this song. Why does the sun? The sun is a mass of
inconvenience. Yes.
And like people hounded you, like that's not true.
Well, I don't remember anyone complaining, but we eventually worked out that actually the title was wrong. It's not made of gas. Somebody pointed out that stars are made of a fourth state of matter called plasma, and this song is a mainstay of our show. You know, we still play the original.
Because it goes from this like kind of like xylophone to a totally rocking song live, right?
Yeah.
But so then you circled back.
Well, we did a cover.
We wrote a response to. The other thing is, I guess it was assumed for time immemorial, I guess, that the sun was on fire, that it was flaming, and that's what was generating all the heat, and that turned out to be incorrect. And I guess this was probably known when... Was it Hizard who wrote the...
The lyrics are from the Golden Book Encyclopedia of 1964.
Right. That wasn't like ancient history.
I think
by then they knew some of this stuff. But in any case, we had to incorporate these facts into a new song for the science record that we put out about less than 10 years ago, in which we explained that the sun is made of plasma. We had to come up with a rhyme for the word plasma, and the only word we could come up with was miasma. So the new song is called The Sun is a Miasma of Incandescent Plasma, which is also not true. It's not a miasma of anything. but it was an attempt to
But it rhymes.
Fix. It was, we're trying to fix the mistake.
Like, physics wasn't born with rhyming in mind. Like, the universe didn't...
Yeah.
Accumulate with thinking, like, is this going to rhyme well when we talk
right,
about...
Right, exactly. If only it were made of gas, and then mass would be an appropriate rhyme.
So can you think of any other song where, like, back and, like, fix, like, write the apology for the earlier song?
Oh, well, we were just talking about this the other day. There was a point in our career where we were working so quickly that, I actually put together a song, lost the original lyric sheet... And then we recorded the song, and about like a year or two later, I was cleaning out my house, and I actually found the original lyrics, and they were so much better. It was extremely frustrating. But I will not name the song because I do not want this in Wikipedia.
That will be like a treasure. Like you'll auction that off.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's like the original lyrics of Yesterday, you know, by Paul McCartney was scrambled eggs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
The, like, the dummy lyrics.
And I don't know who. Yeah, I don't know who advised him on that one.
Oh, I think it was one of the, that was a case. And when we do this sometimes, you come up with the melody and you like the melody, and you're just going to sit on it for a while. But you need to have some
you just
sort
put
of,
some like syllables
yeah.
to it. That
yeah, are, exactly. Yeah.
Scrambled eggs. Okay. So
those are some pretty emotional scrambled eggs.
It is. It's a bit. It's the most recorded scrambled egg lyric. The so you guys brought back Dial-A-Song recently.
We did. Yeah, basically, you know, we started working on our 17th studio album this last summer, and as we were working on it, we were sort of just thinking like, you know, how much do people ever look forward to a band's 17th album?
Yeah, and, is it really 17?
It is, yeah. We've made 17 studio albums. And
wow.
So basically, we thought if we embarked on kind of doing some kind of musical project where we released these songs once a week, it would be a way to just kind of fit into the world. You know, like the way people take in music these days, it's pretty common to, you know, just kind of check out a Facebook. People don't even go to websites to see what's happening with the band. They just assume they're going to find out about it through Facebook or social media of some kind. And so we just started posting these things once a week, and resurrected the Dial-A-Song idea. And it's been great. It's actually really sort of brought back, I think, the proper, you know, context for what we're doing. You know, people really check in.
And so were a lot of people who are currently consuming Dial-A-Song, were they the same people who were using it, you know, 20 or...
That's a good question. I would assume there's got to be some new people.
Have you heard from fans glad you brought it back?
There are new humans since we had started Dial-A-Song.
I think there's actually a large contingent of people who are completely unaware of the original, who are actually just taking part in this as like just a misguided experiment, I mean, one of the nicest things about it is that they are actually they're participating in something that's happening right now. And that, so their relationship to the band is not one of just nostalgia. You know, I mean, you know, no bands are last as long as our band. And I think one of the reasons why is because we've not simply turned into an oldies act.
Yes.
You know? And
we're
so,
running in fear from the past constantly.
Yeah. There's huge explosions behind us.
Exactly. We're running in slow motion away from the exploding past is what it is.
But, I mean, so people really feel like they're participating in, like,
like
an ongoing
the
thing.
Speed the bus. It can't slow down.
Yes.
Exactly.
But like, literally, the old Dial-A-Song was one phone line into the Brooklyn apartment. So if two people called in at the same time, you get a busy signal.
One of them had to wait. Yeah, absolutely.
And so people are probably constantly getting a busy signal. But now with modern technology, nobody gets a busy signal, right?
No. It's much better now.
That's pretty cool. So I'm actually excited to announce that the new Dial-A-Song is now powered by Twilio.
Yes.
Yes.
We're happy
yes.
to be on board.
Which is why you don't get a busy signal.
So if you ever do get a busy signal, you can email me.
That's right. Exactly. The heat is off of us now.
So why don't we take some questions from the audience?
Sure,
absolutely.
We'd like to.
I think there's a microphone there if anybody's got any questions.
We do, we have a microphone here. Who's got a question?
It's all over
I've got a question for the audience. What do you figure the price tag on Alcatraz is?
To
rent, to own.
To own Alcatraz.
To do events.
I don't know, the backstage, our dressing room is like staring at Alcatraz, and I was thinking it seems like it's a...
What a waste.
Well, I mean, you could run the tours anyway, but why not put an internet...
Yeah, you got plenty
of space.
Why not
put a feisty internet startup company in there? Could save on the buses.
Well, you think about the real estate. People say, like, oh, you have a 140-degree view of the bay. Like, you have a 360.
Yes.
Yeah.
Much some better. Real estate agent is, like, drooling about this idea right now.
I'm not telling Google what to do. But I'm saying, the people of San Francisco would be psyched.
It would be. So we've got a man in a red coat.
Hey, how's it going?
Hello.
Good.
I was kind of wondering, do you guys use any sort of like music composition like apps or technology? And like, do you still prefer kind of traditional paper and pen? Or can you be productive with like you know, something that's like an iPad or something like that?
We've been using, I mean, starting when it was a MIDI sequencing application, we've been using Performer for the last, I think, 25 years.
They call it Digital Performer now, John.
Yeah, it's digital. Now it's digital. It was just Performer. And maybe just because we're just too feeble to learn something new. That is what we've been stuck with for all this time.
No, I think from the very beginning, we've always used, our earliest demos, we actually used Music Minus One, or they were called drum drops, and they were like it was a drummer playing like sort of cliche drum parts, and we would actually write the songs to the drummer. So we've always been into kind of computer-assisted, like machine-assisted songwriting, because it is like an extra little booster rocket on what you're doing. So we'll work on the computer, we can work with loops, we record our own loops, we make our own samples, and often kind of use those as like ways to spark our own imaginations about what's possible. Because, you know, if you sample something that's kind of interesting, it can lead to writing a song. I think we're constantly trying to figure out another vehicle, another excuse to write a new song. And it's not just about like finding a good rhyme or finding, you know, getting into the sonic stuff is a great way to do it. So Digital Performer has certainly been a help. You know, samplers and drum machines and all that stuff have been great for us. We love technology.
Thank you.
Sir.
Excuse me. I've been a huge fan since Animaniacs days.
Excellent.
Now,
Did you guys do that song too?
We didn't do the song. We did. It was is Animaniacs the Tiny Toons?
Oh, yeah, Tiny Toons. I'm sorry, you're at Tiny Toons. Yeah.
I can tell you the story of Tiny Toons. We were on our second American tour. We were the average pay. We were playing for about 50 people a night. We were getting guarantees of $200 a night, which we did not deserve. I mean, that's important to remember. Like, basically, we were really newbies touring America. We were basically going broke, and our management got a phone call that said, Steven Spielberg is reopening the Warner Brothers Animation Company. Would you like to be involved? We got a check for $5,000, which at the time, it might as well have been like, we've got a check for $1 million. And we said, yes.
But that wasn't your question.
No, that doesn't count as an answer from
right.
me.
Okay.
Thank you. So, next question.
So I've loved you since then. Now that I have little kids, I hate you because of hot dog, right. Plays incessantly.
We're sorry.
So your kids' music is great. You actually make very, very good kids' music. So my question is it different than the music you made previously? Tonally or mechanically, or is making kids' music different?
Well, we're very conscious of the fact that it's music for kids, but we also made a conscious choice not to make it crappier because it's for kids. You know, I had a friend who was like, I see you didn't lower your standards because you could get away with it somehow. Kids, you know, can't complain as loudly or something.
Well, there's also this thing about kids' music where it tends to be kind of peaceful, and our kids' music tends to be kind of rowdy in comparison, and it's hard to know why that is. I mean, some kids obviously like peaceful music, but you can't help but think maybe it's really for the moms.
Yeah, exactly.
That it's not quite.
Well, and in that sense, we also, this was another conscious choice. We didn't want to make music that parents would object to having to listen to over and over and over again. Thank you very much. Yes, as a parent, I'm aware of that problem.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
I'll tell you one quick thing before. My son loves Birdhouse in Your Soul. And he loves both the live version and the album version. And he asked for it all the time. And I got really sick of actually loading up like the Sonos app on my phone because he'd ask all the time. He says, play Birdhouse, right? And then other times he says, play other Birdhouse, like meaning the live version.
Right.
And so I actually made an Arduino with two big, like a red button and a blue button. That is actually like giant plunger buttons that's in our house, and he just hits the blue button and it talks to Sonos and it plays Birdhouse in Your Soul like throughout our whole house. And it's just like self-service Birdhouse buttons.
I love that, yeah.
That could also be just like a prison sentence.
Yeah.
Well, at least he's got a choice.
Yeah.
I get to decide when it's plugged in.
right. Oh, good. Well, anyway.
Sorry.
Hi, I just want to say thank you because on some of my seventh grade science tests, there was stuff about the music you guys do, and it really helped me.
Anytime.
Very good.
Oh, so this lady was waiting at the other mic, but we never picked on the other mic. You jump ahead. You were waiting patiently.
Thanks. I think that mic's off.
Yeah.
First off, wanted to say, if you do go to Alcatraz, you could hold an awesome concert because no one could ever leave.
Yeah.
Good point.
Possible.
Captive audience.
I was wondering how, if you were starting today, you think things would be different?
I feel sorry for a band starting today. I feel like it'd be very hard to get noticed no matter what you did.
I feel like we'd be literally wearing barrels, you know, like with suspenders to hold up the thing that you that you know about that nobody actually does.
I don't know how it would be almost impossible. I mean, it seems like
we were supremely lucky even when we started, when there still was a music industry. I mean, we were lucky in that regard, but we also had a lot of lucky breaks over the course of that time, you know. Even when there was still a bunch of money available for bands, and we fully exploited the major label experience we had and everything. So now we're in a position where we get to exploit this kind of free form, you know, everything's just up for grabs.
I mean, there is a tremendous advantage with things like Kickstarter existing for bands that have a distinct point of view. But I think the thing that's unfortunate about it is that a lot of those best bands don't really ever get a platform to speak to a wider audience. And I think the culture, the bands might be better for it, but I think the culture is worse for it. That, like, you know, somebody with an extreme point of view is actually not pushed on the general public. And so there's, you know, there's something great about the public being tested in that way. Like, if somebody actually has a curatorial power over kind of a general audience, it's nice when the Alice Cooper comes along or the Marilyn Manson comes along and goes, like, deal with this. And I think that, unfortunately, we live in this sort of post-Insane Clown Posse world where it's like all those people are just... who are predisposed to like that kind of music are just sitting in their mom's basement going, kill, kill, and then nobody else is hearing about it. You know, it doesn't get it. You got to open those windows sometimes.
Right.
Hi, I also wanted to say thank you because, like my sister, you guys saved me on so many tests. Like, probably you're the reason I passed middle school. But also, I was wondering. There are so many songs out there that are like love songs. That's like the majority of songs out there. What made you guys think science? I want to write a song about the elements and the sun. Like, well, where was your inspiration?
Yeah, we were tasked with writing a science album as part of this Disney series that we did. So there was actually a theme to the science album already kind of ordained, which, you know, made it easy for us. Like, well, give us a theme, we'll just write songs about that. But I think they kind of thought we were an appropriate, you know, act to, as opposed to Insane Clown Posse, you know.
Right. Magnets?
It would be a different kind of science album. We're not educators. We didn't do super great in school. But we like...
Don't want to talk about it, John.
You know, I think we feel positive about all that, that, you know, informational kind of stuff.
I think we have time for one more.
So you've talked a lot about how you're using digital technology, but in the reverse of that, what was it like working at the Edison Museum and recording there?
Well, that was another like trip into technology because we were invited to record on a wax cylinder recorder, which was a pre-electrical recording device that was developed by the Thomas Edison Laboratory people. And basically, it's a different format, but it's a predecessor to the regular
phonograph.
But because it doesn't use electricity, capturing the performance or reproducing the performance. So you actually have this incredible physical burden of capturing enough sound pressure through a stylus to embed the actual audio into a groove-making machine.
That's right. The energy of the sound is what's driving the little
stylus and carving the wax. So it that also affects the performance in a way that you can hear on pre-electric recordings very clearly. There's a style of arrangement and performance that is very much shaped by that technological constraint, and it was in our case too. In fact, we had to sing in these old-timey voices in order to be heard properly, and that affected the entire recording. And for some reason, I affected an English voice.
And your pants also moved up.
My pants were much higher. But it was really, it was super fun, and we, you know, we used those recordings on some CDs that we've. So you can hear the stuff we cut at the Edison Laboratory. We also got souvenir wax cylinders.
Yeah, it was just a total like once
really,
in a lifetime.
Really fun, super fun experience.
That guy was smart.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Cheers.
Thank you all.
Thanks.
All right, one last question for you. Will you play some music for us?
Absolutely.
Let's hear it. Thank you very much, John.
Thanks a lot. Nice talking to you.
John.
Really a pleasure.
Fantastic. Really appreciate it. We're looking forward to hearing you guys play in about half an hour.
All right, yes.
So grab some drinks. We've got some food. We've got some beverage.
Great.
We'll be back in half an hour with the Johns and the rest of the band.
See you soon.
That's it.
Go away.
Great job.
Thanks. Fantastic. That was fun.